Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Welcome to another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast, episode 25, and my guest this week is Hope Virgo. Hope Virgo is a leading international and award-winning advocate for people with eating disorders. She's an activist, a campaigner, and the author of two books, Stand Tall Little Girl and Hope Through Recovery, and she actively campaigns for change in the way that eating disorders are diagnosed and treated. So I really was keen to do an episode about eating disorders, and I mentioned this to Hope in the kind of the intro to it, that I feel that they're often missed out from the mental health conversation, partly because there's a lot of physical consequences, and partly because people think it's a food thing, but it's not a food thing. You know, eating disorders are very much a mental health issue. It's very much a mental illness, and that, yeah, they always kind of get swept to one side. So I wanted to kind of like learn a bit more for myself, really, because I didn't know a great deal. It's not something I've got any first-hand experience with, not to my knowledge anyway. And so it just made sense to speak to Hope, because she's kind of the go-to person in the eating disorder world. So, you know, she's been on the telly, she's been on the radio, she's been in the papers. And if anyone is discussing eating disorders anywhere, then Hope Virgo gets the call. So she's doing amazing things and she's speaking to all sorts of people. So the fact that she was able to give me some of her time to chat to me and my little podcast was absolutely fantastic, you know. And it's a really good conversation. Hope is absolutely lovely and she's so passionate about what she's doing. I'd say the best way to describe Hope Virgo is a force of nature, because she's getting stuff done, you know. And I think she's one of those people that if you had to back anyone to make the changes that she's trying to make, it would be her. Like, she ain't messing around with this stuff, and it's really inspiring to chat to her about it. And she's doing so much more than raising awareness, you know. So she's actually trying to make changes to the system of how eating disorders are managed. And because, yeah, the system is not serving people very well right now. And that's not a slight in any way on the medical professionals. It's the system itself, you know, the system that they have to use, the sort of the guidelines and the rules and regs, so to speak. They need changing because people are not getting the help that they deserve. They're not getting the help that they need. And Hope's kind of like setting out to change these things. So it's absolutely incredible what she's doing. It's going to make, you know, she makes so much difference. She holds so much space for people that it really is incredible. Like I say, it's inspiring. And it's a great chat. We kind of get into how this all came about, Hope's own struggles with her own eating disorder and how that went on for a few years. We talk about where that came from, how that manifested and how that affected her life, how that affects the people around her. We talk about her time in a mental health hospital. We talk about what happened when she came out of that. And we talk about her, you know, her current stage of ongoing recovery, and we talk about, you know, the end goal of full recovery and everything in between. And it's a fascinating insight. And I think if we're gonna, I talk a lot on the podcast about compassion and how we all need to be compassionate for ourselves and compassionate for other people. Just because we haven't experienced this or experienced someone else experiencing this, then it's even more important for us to be compassionate towards people that are going through these things, because that's how we make change, right? So we don't have to just be compassionate towards stuff that affects us. You know, we're looking at the big picture of mental health and mental illness, and we all need to kind of be in it together, you know, and spread that compassion around. So, it's a great episode for that. So, I really hope you enjoy it. Normally, I end this intro by nagging for reviews and subscribes and likes and follows and all that sort of stuff. I'm not today. I'm going to ask you, instead of doing that, to spend the same time or probably less amount of time and go to www.hopevirgo.com and you can access there some petitions for some of her campaigns she's got going on at the moment. So when these petitions hit a certain amount of signatures, she can then take them to Parliament and, you know, start really fighting for these changes. So do that, please. Yeah, don't bother leaving a review. Go and give them a sign, go and give them a read, see what they're all about. And yeah, you know, like I say, we need to have compassion for each other. And just because you haven't experienced this or aren't experiencing this, that still mean you can still lend your voice to the cause. You know, that's kind of the whole point. We can still get behind it, get behind hope, and, you know, see if we can help and make these changes by signing these forms. So instead of leaving me a review, instead of subscribing, any of that, go and sign these forms. It's electronic. It takes seconds. It's quicker than leaving a review because you don't have to think up loads of nice words or anything like that. You can just go and sign it. You can connect with Hope on Instagram at HopeVirgo_, and there's links in her bios again to all these things, and you can see much more about what she's about, what she's up to, and what she's trying to change. If you want to get hold of me about this episode or any other episodes at Proper Mental Podcast, just give me a shout, and that is everything you need to know. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. It really, really is a belter. It was actually a really weird sort of coincidence. A couple of weeks before Hope and I chatted, it was her birthday, and I saw on her Instagram story that she was out with some friends, and I recognized one of her friends, and it was someone that my wife and I, when we worked in Italy years ago, crikey, about 10 or 12 years ago, we worked with one of Hope's friends, and I mentioned this to Hope, and it turns out she came out to Italy to visit her friend that summer, which is mad, really. So it means that, you know, back in the day in Italy, on an Italian campsite, that Hope and I might have been in the same space at the same time and walked past each other. So yeah, that was a bit mad, but it was really cool to kind of have that connection, and it got the conversation off to a really, really good start. It was a great way to break the ice. So yeah, Hope was just fantastic. She's brilliant. And I really hope you enjoyed this episode. It's episode 25 of the Proper Mental Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. The guest is Hope Virgo. Enjoy. Thank you very much for joining me today, Hope. And yeah, thank you very much for rearranging. I had to cancel, didn't I, last minute with due to do this a couple of weeks ago. But I really, really appreciate your time. I've got to admit, Hope, I know very little about eating disorders. I've been doing some research for this, and that's part of the reason why I think it's a really important conversation for me to have, because if I don't know enough, then there's other people that don't know enough, right? And the more we can talk about the things, we can more that make that more get that in front of people, get it in their ears, so to speak. And I was thinking about it from the big view of mental health, and I think that sometimes, maybe you, I don't know if you agree with this, that eating disorders maybe get forgotten about a little bit in the conversation because there is such physical consequences. People forget that it's part of the mental health conversation. Is that, am I on the right lines with that type of
thing? Yeah, no, definitely. I feel that so strongly. I think it's an illness that's so massively misunderstood, one which has so much stigma around it. And because, like you said, it often has physical side effects to it, people get so fixated on the physical side effects that we don't take into account that it is a mental health issue. And I think that's why so often when it comes to services, when it comes to funding, everything like that, often eating disorders get completely left off everything, because they're kind of going through the physical health services and the mental health services, and it's like, where do they really fit?
Yeah, sure. Almost kind of falls down the cracks, I suppose. Yeah. And with a lot of mental health stuff, it's almost, because there isn't a physical thing, it almost doesn't exist, and people find that, so they think of it more mental. But then, yeah, with eating disorders, because it rolls around food, and food is a physical thing, right? And people think that food's the thing, but food is not the thing. There's a thing behind the thing, if that makes any sort of sense.
It is. And I think that, again, it's so hard, because I'm always saying to people, I'm like, it's not about food, it's not about weight. And they're like, but it is. I'm like, no, it's not. It's that's how we present that we're not okay. And that's a sign that something so much bigger is going on. And I think, again, because of the food issue, it adds another layer of stigma and kind of complications, because when you're in recovery, you have to choose to eat. Yeah. And eating disorders aren't a choice, but yet you're choosing to eat when you're in. It's like this weird kind of thing that goes on. But I think because of all of those, and because we have to have the food, again, it fuels that stigma and that lack of understanding. And I hear it all the time from people. They're like, oh, it's just a choice. Like, it's a diet gone wrong. It's a phase. I'm like, no, it's not. I'm like, it's a mental illness. But because of the physicalness, we don't often remember that.
Yeah, no, and you know, I think it's very important for people to realize, right, for us to widen that conversation. But just, I mean, if we talk about anorexia, Hope, because obviously that's your lived experience, and we don't have to talk about, you know, you specifically, but how does something like anorexia, how does it start to manifest in the first place? You know, how does that creep in? And when it happens, do you know that it's happening? Do you know that that's what you're dealing with?
Yeah, really good question. And I think firstly, like, it's so unique to everyone. So every single person will have different triggers, different causes, things like that. But looking kind of broadly at it, so we know that people with anorexia have, it's based 50 to 60% on your genetics. And then you normally have a trigger. So something that will cause you to then go on to develop an eating disorder. And a trigger could be anything from a trauma. It could be from calorie counting. It could be from going on a diet. Anything like that might then cause the eating disorder to start to develop. So in my case, I was sexually abused, and that traumatic event was something that kind of caused me to start to look for another coping mechanism in life. And I always think about the anorexia as like being like a little bit like a best friend and your worst enemy all at the same time. It gives you so much reassurance, so much value, so much purpose. And you really, really love how it makes you feel. It makes you feel good enough. It distracts you, all of that sort of stuff. But then over a prolonged period of time, it actually can be really, really detrimental to that person. And I know for me, it started off being something that was amazing. But then over time, I was never quite doing enough for it. I was never quite like restricting enough or exercising hard enough. And I then was like trying to push myself to be the best at it, because I knew that if I was the best at it, I'd feel good enough and I'd be okay. And that all my emotions would switch off and it would numb all of that pain and get that control back. And I think quite often with people, you don't realize there's anything going on. They're very, very secretive illnesses. And the longer they're left untreated, the more those behaviors become so ingrained, and then the more normal those behaviors become. Yeah. So when you start to recover, you have to firstly kind of, I guess, accept that something's the matter, which for some people can take years and years. And the second thing you have to do is realize that actually all of those behaviors that you had before around food and maybe exercise weren't really that healthy. And actually that's not normal. And normal eating looks like this on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, sure. I think it's anything where you're dealing with something where you lead to be getting diagnosed, we tend to think of diagnosis as a start point, but it's not. You've been living with it for a long period of time and then you get a diagnosis, right? And quite often when something's diagnosed, that can almost be a shock. You know, that can almost, you know, was it strange for you the first time someone said, oh, we think you've got anorexia? We were like a bit like, oh, what?
Yeah, I literally was in like complete denial about it. I had this image in my head of people with anorexia that they had to be like sick thin. They were all like models, like walking the catwalk. They didn't like food. They didn't eat. And I my whole body image got really distorted when I was unwell. But also it wasn't that I didn't like food, and I did eat occasionally. So it was like, I was like, that's not me. Like, I don't have this thing the matter with me. And they spent, I remember the first couple of kind of appointments at CAMS, like trying to kind of scare me into eating and trying to get me to have stuff. And none of those shock tactics worked. Like, it just didn't help. I needed to have concrete evidence that something was categorically wrong with the way that I viewed myself and the way that I viewed food. And no one could give that for me, actually, for probably about 6 months. And even when I eventually got admitted to an inpatient ward, it took about 3 days for me to start gathering that evidence and to start to accept that something wasn't quite right. But I think with eating disorders, like, they're so sneaky. Like, they use any opportunity to try and pull you back in. And you then, again, start to normalize those behaviors. So maybe, I don't know, you might not put butter on your toast, and you do it once and then you do it again and you do it again and again and again. And then gradually it's like, oh, now you're doing that. Like, maybe just cut out carbs or cut out this or cut out this. And so then over like a period of time, your behaviors start to go back to what you think is normal, but actually it's really, really unhealthy. And I think, like, at the moment, and given the pandemic and this whole fixation on food and exercise and bodies, like we've just, all of us have, well, not all of us, but a lot of us, I would say, have a really unhealthy relationship with food. And we've just totally normalized that. And I'm like, that's not okay. Like for me, if you sit anywhere on that disordered eating spectrum, that's when something isn't quite right.
Yeah, sure. And it gets so complicated, doesn't it? Because obviously it's something we need to survive, to live. And yet food is so, so complicated. And as humans, we can make that complicated, but we're not like it about water. You know, we're not like it about air and, you know, the other things. And I suppose a lot of that is societal, right, as well, you know, like these, the idea of what health looks like and what is, you know, what health is, to eat healthy and how we should look and all that sort of stuff. It's a confusing space, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think on top of that, it's like on social media and like, I don't think social media causes eating disorders, just to kind of caveat what I'm about to say. But you do get a lot of really, really unhealthy messaging out there as well. And even from like these kind of so-called wellness influencers who we just trust everything they say because they've got millions of followers. And I'm like, that diet they're on is not healthy. Like pushing calorie counting is not healthy. And for me, it's like actually as a society, we've got something like that's just categorically wrong with the way that we think about food and exercise. And it's sad like that. With the pandemic, like some people's biggest fear about lockdown easing and things starting to go back to normal is like, oh, I've put on weight or my body's changed. And I'm like, how is that? Like, that shouldn't be something that we're sad about. It shouldn't be a fear, but it kind of is.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, crikey, if you've got through it, then that's the main thing, right?
Yeah.
Getting out the other side is the achievement. Yeah, completely. How, before you started getting help, Hope, how long were you struggling with this on your own for before you got to that point?
About 4 years.
Wow.
So yeah, I kind of developed it when I was about 12, 13, and it first got picked up when I was probably about 16, kind of going on 17. My school actually contacted my mum after the summer holidays, kind of after my GCSEs. I came back to school, and over that summer things had got quite difficult. We were having a lot of arguments around food at home, and I also had spent quite a lot of time kind of away with my friends that summer, and I just couldn't get my head around the fact that everybody else was okay to eat and drink what they wanted to, and I couldn't do that. So I think kind of subconsciously, I probably thought something was a little bit different about me, but I was so ashamed about the fact that I kind of had this voice in my head, and I was so worried about what people would think. And I was also just convinced that at some point it would just disappear and that life would go back to some sense of normality for me. So I did just become very, very good at hiding everything pretty much. And I think, again, that's the really scary thing with eating disorders is we hide it, and often people don't lose weight. People might stay the same shape, the same size, or if they lose weight or change their muscular physique, we start to compliment that. So I'd gone through all of those compliments, all of those changes, and then it was kind of just stopped, and then I just began hiding it so much more.
Yeah, sure. And it's like, from your family's point of view, is that, did they know that, you know, did they think, oh, something's going on with Hope, or did they know? Because it's so, because you, as the person suffering and dealing with it, you have so much control that it can be very difficult for anyone else to step in and help. Like, people can be available to help, they can offer that support, but ultimately no one can make you do anything you don't want to do, right? And if you're not mentally well, then you ain't going to want to do, you're not going to want to reach out.
Yeah. And no, so I think there were moments when my mum probably thought something wasn't quite right, but she didn't, I don't think she felt able to really do anything about it. And I don't think that's her fault. I think it's just the kind of way things are quite often with eating disorders and with other mental health issues as well. And I think you end up, you get very good at masking it, don't you? And kind of showing one side of yourself to everybody. But as I first went to the GP, and then I got referred to the Children's Adolescent Mental Health Services, so CAMHS. And when I got referred to CAMHS, I think at that point in my first assessment, it was clear that my mum had thought something wasn't quite right for quite a long time, but hadn't really known, I think, what to do about it. And although I'm only 31, like actually when I was growing up, no one really talked about eating disorders. Like, I think the stigma's come a little bit of a way, but back then, like, it was just something that we didn't talk about at all. And I think, like, for my mum, like it was challenging. We'd grown up in a family where we'd had massive family meal times and all of that sort of stuff. And yes, there'd been arguments and things like that, but she tried to create a safe space, and something obviously hadn't really worked.
Yeah, I think it's as well, it's important to mention as well from a parent's point of view that teenagers do some weird stuff, right? And you know, you are kind of expected to fall out with your parents a little bit. You are kind of expected to hide things from them. You are kind of, so I think when you know, if you are behaving a little off, there is a certain element of like, oh, that's just my teenager being a teenager, you know? So it's got to be incredibly hard from a family perspective to kind of work out exactly what's going on.
I agree, and I think that's the thing, like I'm not a parent, and I think it must just be like a minefield being a parent, particularly with teenagers probably. But I do think like girls and boys go through phases where they probably diet a little bit, they probably kind of, I don't know, worry about what they look like, kind of have stuff going on, are argumentative, can be quite bratty probably at times, but we just hope that it will pass. And maybe as a parent, that's what you kind of hang on to, is like, actually, this is normal, like, this is okay. And I think that's the thing. And something that parents quite often ask me is like, how do you know when someone's crossing over from just being on a diet into an eating disorder? And the line is so thin. And I think, again, that's probably what makes it even harder to spot it and to make sure people are getting that support.
Yeah, definitely. With a lot of mental illness, there is a very blurred lines. You know, people seem to think of it in terms of it either is or it isn't. And it either happens to me or it doesn't. And that's just really, really not the case, is it? We can kind of like weave between those things. Almost seamlessly for quite a long time before we get to a place where someone needs to step in or help's needed. So once you started with CAMS, what was next? How does that work then? What's the next, the first steps of recovery then?
Yeah, so I went there for about 6 months as an outpatient. So I would go kind of for weekly weigh-ins, weekly therapy, things like that. Didn't really enjoy it. Didn't really get on with my therapist. He was a guy. So I think arguably that might have made it a little bit harder. And then kind of lied my way through every single week, pretending like life was fine, everything's fine. And then eventually after 6 months, got admitted to an inpatient ward, where I spent kind of the next year. So in that hospital, like, had kind of intensive therapy, did lots of one-to-one therapy, did lots of group therapy, also went back to like the real basics around eating and having that structure in place. And I think in that sense, the structure was just what I needed, like having an understanding of actually what my body needs, how I can get enough food into my kind of day to day, but also having that space after meals to just be like, yeah, I ate that, but I feel awful today. I feel rubbish. I don't like it. Like, and all of that sort of kind of space to unpack all of my fears around it.
Yeah.
And it really helped. I think like it saved my life, but I think it also left me with a lot of stuff that I hadn't really had time to process. Eating disorder treatment in some places is fantastic, but in a lot of situations, it is just about refeeding someone and getting them to a healthy weight and getting them to kind of stabilize and manage that. And so it meant that when I did leave treatment, I was extremely institutionalized. So I was very kind of structured in my food and my exercise and my kind of drinks as well. And it took me probably about 2 years to really move away from actually kind of obsessively calorie counting every single thing that I was putting into my body.
Yeah, I suppose those steps, when if they've helped us to achieve something, then you almost get reluctant to step away from them, right? Because you think, oh, without these processes, I identify that like a lot. You know, I have certain things that I that I need keep me on track and that I do day to day, and then sometimes if it's been a couple of days, I can almost panic, you know, thinking, oh, I haven't done this and I haven't done that. So I get that a lot. And you mentioned so when within eating disorders and you talk about recovery and you talk about like ongoing recovery, how is there a point where the recovery comes complete, or is it always ongoing? Like, is that just thinking about the terminology around it,
you know? No, it's a really good question. It's something that I do think about quite a lot, actually. So I believe that full recovery is possible. I do believe that, and 100% I'm certain that it will eventually happen for me. At the moment, I am in an I am in an ongoing state of recovery. So I know what I need to do. I know how to eat. I know how to exercise, all of that sort of stuff. But I also know that there are situations in life that I find quite triggering, that I haven't fully kind of relinquished all of that control over food. And there are certain things that I do still find quite difficult. We know kind of statistically that 50% of people make a full recovery. 20% of people remain chronically unwell for the rest of their lives. And 30% of people kind of coast along and settle at where they're at. I think for me, I thought I'd made a full recovery in my probably my third year at uni. And then after I came through a relapse back in 2016, I definitely had just settled. And something that I've realized, I think, over the last year with the pandemic and just having more time to think about things, I think I realized that actually throughout my journey, I've made so many mistakes. I still kind of had foods that I wouldn't eat. I still calorie counted. I still compensated from time to time. And I still was using the eating disorder as a bit of a coping mechanism. And so now I work closely with a dietitian. And within that kind of I'm unpacking a lot more of the fears around food and kind of various anxieties around things. And a lot of it for me is now just challenging myself to have food that maybe I find slightly harder, and sitting with a lot of that emotion and reminding myself that all of the fears that I have around rejection and abandonment are not based on my body image and based on what I look like and based on what I eat. And I think now I'm able to see that and understand that a lot more. It definitely helps me to just kind of step further forward within it. But I think a big thing in recovery is like, you've got to just keep going. Like, it can get so tiring. And I was thinking like last night, actually, like over the last couple of weeks, I've got really frustrated with things. Like, I feel like I'm in this real kind of waiting game at the moment where I really want to be well, like I'm doing everything right. I'm keeping pushing myself, keeping challenging all the behaviors. I'm talking a lot about my feelings and my emotions, like all of this sort of stuff, but I've just not got there yet. And I set myself this goal that by the end of August, so I'm getting married at the end of August.
Oh, congrats. And
thanks. I was like, I want to be well, but 100% well by then. Like, I don't want to be stressed about my wedding and the food and what I look like and all of that sort of stuff. And I think because I've added that pressure on myself, that's probably why I'm getting slightly frustrated at the moment. But I do think it is like, you just got to keep putting one step in front of the other. And eventually I think that kind of full recovery will come. But it's hard. And I think like for some people, their probably recovery might look a bit different to them, and they might be okay to kind of be where they're at, and that's okay. Like, it's fine. But I think for me, it was like, actually, I didn't want to have my future, which is dictated by food and emotion and control and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure. You don't want your future dictated by your past, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's I really like the term ongoing recovery, and I've not heard it used in any other aspect of mental health and mental illness, you know. And I think it's so true. We go through something, no matter what that something is. You come out the other side and you think, you know, you might have done certain things to come out the other side, and you think, oh, I've cracked it. And then all the things that you did to come out the other side just fall by the wayside. Yeah. And you know, you've got to, I've had two sort of quite major breakdowns, and I know the reason the second one happened is because after the first one I thought I'd nailed it, you know. I thought, I've done the work, you know I'm saying. But you know, you do have to keep sort of working the program, for want of a better a better phrase. But then I also think what you mentioned there about, you know, sitting in the feelings and just accepting and that sort of stuff, because with any sort of recovery, with any sort of work, I find as well, like the harder you push, the harder it pushes back. And it's almost like a journey down a river, you know. You've just got to kind of let it take you at its own pace almost, right? And if you try and sort of really, really force these things, maybe you're forcing something, you know, that someone might be forcing something that they're not quite ready for or something.
Yeah, like, and that. I do think it is like, you've got to work out your boundaries and where you're at with things. And I know, like, sometimes I have to sit down and be like, right, I've challenged myself so much this week, I just need a bit of an easier day. And I do feel like that's actually okay. As long as you're not going backwards, I'm like, that's fine, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. I sometimes feel as well, if I've been a bit lapsed, it's almost as if I get a little tap on the shoulder, you know, something will happen. I get a tap on the shoulder saying, "No, come on, you ain't finished yet." You know, it's like you've had a bit of a rest. Time to crack on. Yeah. So you go for all these things and you go and get help and you're in recovery and stuff like that. When did you start feeling able to start holding space for other people? When did the idea of like writing a book and you know, sharing your story and stuff like that, how does that start to enter the picture?
Yeah, so after I came through my relapse in 2016, I was just so fed up and frustrated by like the whole system. I'd reached out for support and hadn't been able to get it because I wasn't underweight, and I was just so angry about that. I was like, this is ridiculous. I was like, no one understands. It's a mental illness. It's not a physical illness. I felt like there was a huge lack of understanding. And I also was really struggling to find kind of literature out there from people who'd been through an eating disorder. And whilst there was some stuff out there, I just didn't feel like I could relate to it, I think. And so I decided off the back of kind of coming through that I was just going to take a bit of time to kind of plot out my journey, like see where things were at and stuff like that. And ended up, yeah, like writing a book about it and kind of started, like when it came out, doing like a little bit of speaking around it, was kind of invited into schools and stuff. And the more I shared about what I'd been through, and mainly the fact that I'd been turned away from treatment when I relapsed, the more people were like, that happened to me, like this happened to me. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And off the back of that, I was sitting in the pub one evening with some friends and I was like, do you know what? Like, I need to do something about this. I was like, this is so frustrating. And I kind of mapped out really, really vaguely on a napkin what dump the scales would look like and how this might happen and what my kind of key asks were around it. And it kind of just went from there. Like, I was working full time for the first year, kind of trying to do a lot of the kind of campaigning alongside kind of having a job and stuff, and went away for 3 weeks and came back and was like, I don't want to do my full-time job. Like, I want to change. I want to go into this space. I want to campaign and talk about it. And it kind of just went from there. And it's been really up and down, actually. I'll say it's been really good, but it has actually been really up and down. Like, some days I absolutely love it. Some days I hate it. I think putting yourself out there, it's hard for anyone, but I think particularly with eating disorders, people still really judge like my weight and my body. And I get a lot of messages from people being like, oh, like your weight looks like it's changed slightly. You've put on weight, you've lost weight. And I'm like, literally, like, that is nothing to do with you. Like, that doesn't kind of relate to how my mental health is. And so trying to navigate a lot of that stuff, I think, can be hard. But yeah, I tend to really love it. You've caught me on probably like a funny day because I've just had the most frustrating response from the Minister for Mental Health about the calorie labelling legislation. So normally I'd probably be like, I love it all the time. But there are moments where I'm literally like, why are they not listening? Like, why is this not changing? Why aren't people getting it?
Yeah.
But it's exciting. And I think like this week, like I've just launched like a steering group, which is made up of kind of experts. So kind of dietitians, psychiatrists, someone who works in genetics, some carers, and doing things like that now and trying to kind of collaborate a little bit more, I think for me is really, really helpful because it removes me from just kind of having my face out there, just talking about myself. And kind of gives me a little bit more space to actually be like, actually, this is like an overview of what's going on, if that makes sense.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, when you have yourself as, when you've got any sort of profile in any sort of space, then yeah, it's just open to so much stuff, really, whether it's people asking for help or people sharing their opinion, whether you've asked for it or not. I still can't believe we live in a society where people think it's okay to comment on what strangers look like. What is that? Like, it makes no sense at all. Like, what goes through someone's head where they go, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to message that person about what they look like. I just find it so, it's alien to me, but it's massive. That's the culture we live in, right? And social media takes down a barrier. I think people would possibly see with anyone with any sort of profile would not see you as Hope the person. They'd see you as Hope the campaigner. And that means that they can maybe say things and ask things that aren't appropriate, you know?
I think, yeah, I do agree with that. I think I've, I saw this thing actually recently on Instagram, where it was like, just to try, like encouraging people to be mindful that actually people who are putting themselves out there, whether you're campaigning, whether you're doing podcasts, whatever it is, like we all have our own stuff going on. And I think sometimes people forget that. And whilst, and I was debating actually whether to share it or not on my Instagram story. And I chose not to, because I didn't want people to feel like I was having a go or like not wanting people to message me if they've got stuff going on. But I do think there is something in that. And maybe as individuals, it's like, if we're putting ourselves out there doing what we're doing, it's like we need to work out what our boundaries are within that as well, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, completely. You can't do all the jobs, right? You can't, yeah. You know, it's, I think it's handy to, you know, almost have like systems in place. So if depending on what messages land in your inbox, maybe you can point people in a certain direction, or, you know, offer them certain, you know, because there's people's job who is out there is to support, you know, like for me personally, I am happy to talk about these things and I'm happy to hold space in that way, but I can't help individual people. I'm not trained for that. I can't do those sorts of things, you know? So, you know, yeah, it's just trying to make people aware, isn't it, of where they can go to get the help they need, because quite often people reach out to the first point of contact, which is not necessarily the best point of contact, I suppose.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about the calorie thing that you just mentioned as well, because that's kind of very prominent at the moment. And it kind of ties into what we've just chatted about as well, about holding space for other people, because I think like if you've been through something in anything, any sort of like big thing, I find that a lot of people that go through stuff, a lot of people I speak to, it does give them a real sense of like compassion afterwards. You know, you want to stop people going through what you've been through. You know, we're a compassionate bunch in this space. But then when you're trying to make change, like with the calories counts on menus, you're dealing with people who maybe aren't looking at it quite so compassionately, you know, people who aren't willing to look at all the angles. And that must be incredibly frustrating when you're trying to do good and there's people out there who are saying, well, I'm going to do good this way, and that way is not the best, not the best way. If I think that's quite a rambled half question there, but
no, I get what you're saying.
What I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the calorie thing is so contested, because like, I guess like, so firstly, like the evidence is there. It doesn't encourage weight loss. It might do in the short term, but people who go on a calorie counting diet do not keep that weight off. We know that, like the science is there. They've done it in the US and it hasn't worked. And we also know that 25% of people who start calorie counting will go on to develop an eating disorder. And then 35% will remain in a really disordered relationship with their body, with food, for the rest of their lives. And it's so frustrating, because I've tried to do the facts. I've gone out there being like, actually, this is factually inaccurate. It's wrong. But because it's such an easy thing for the government to do, it's such an easy thing for people to start to do, that people then get into this mindset that this is the way to do it, this is the only way to tackle it. And we know that our bodies are so intelligent, and if we eat less and move more, our bodies will start changing and trying to rebalance our energy, and we go into compensatory behaviors. So it's like, this stuff, it doesn't work. It's not scientifically accurate. And I do also think, kind of on that, like as well, if you were to go out in the evening and you hadn't had an eating disorder, or you didn't struggle with your body image or food, you would sit down at that menu and you would look at the calories. Everyone's going to look at it, probably. Some people won't really care and will ignore it, but most people, I do think, will have a conversation around it, open it up. And people with eating disorders will definitely be fixated on that. And they're the people that are going to be really negatively affected by this. But I think in other situations, we'll see people who maybe will check a menu beforehand, see how many calories are in the food they're going to get, and then probably like restrict throughout the whole day, which then will just put their body into a weird kind of balance and out of balance, and it will hang on to all of that food. And I'm like, how can people not understand that? So yeah, it's frustrating. And I think for me at the moment, it's like trying to work out, particularly with that, like how to get people to understand like that it's not going to work, but also how to get people to understand that kind of mental health aspect. And even like my other half knows about my eating disorder, and he knows the impact that it would have on people with eating disorders. But he did say, he was like, if I was a kind of a random person listening to you talking about it, I wouldn't really realize the impact. So I think for me, it's like, yeah, this morning I've been trying to think, actually, what can I do to get regular people to really, really understand, like, actually what is, yeah, like the dangerous side of it, but also trying to look at other things we can do instead.
Yeah, sure. And I think, like, the frustrating thing, I think, is that we should all look at it like that, right? So rather than you thinking, what can I do? We should all be saying, what can I do? Because if calories on a menu, if you're neither here or there about it, then can't we set it up in a way that it's going to help the people that it is going to impact? Like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of, if a certain demographic is going to be massively affected by it, even if there is another chunk of people who are kind of like, oh, well, I'm quite curious, or I would quite like it. Well, there's a difference between I would quite like something to I would genuinely like to remove it and make a difference to someone that it is going to massively affect. And we, as a society, with any sort of mental illness, that's what we're missing. We are missing compassion towards others. And it's very difficult, because if you haven't experienced something, it is very hard to be compassionate for something you haven't experienced, and there's stigma about it, and you don't understand it, and all these sorts of things. But it's lacking. And from like from the political perspective, and I don't want to go down the political route with this at all, but it's societally as well, it's like people making decisions on our behalf. And but where's the empowerment? Where's the education? You know, there's like all this stuff around food and eating disorders, and the other end of the spectrum with, like, you know, obesity and stuff like that. Where's the education? Where's the empowerment? Where's the, you know, just putting some numbers on a menu is not going to change. Do you know what I mean? The people that they're trying to positively impact with it, it's not going to make the least bit of difference, and it's going to impact this entire demographic that they've not even thought of. And that's
I agree. And I think that is the thing. It's like, it is about education and empowering people to make the right decisions, and getting people to understand their bodies and to understand what healthy eating might look like. And in Brazil, actually, they have, they don't calorie count. They have really good guidance around food, kind of encouraging a lot of home cooked food, encouraging things in moderation, like not labeling things as good and bad. And I'm like, why can't we do that here? And yes, families might be dysfunctional, and you might not have a home cooked meal, but if we're educating people on what that looks like, actually, that could be a good starting point. And I know back when I was in school, and I don't even know if they still do this today, I went to a girls' school, and we did like home ec. So like, where we had to like cook a meal. It wasn't very enjoyable, but like they got us to cook things that like we could cook for our family, or that we would eat, and whatever it might have been. And actually, maybe it's thinking about, like, I know schools do a huge amount, but actually, what kind of education can we put out there that's like that, where we're encouraging people to cook a nice meal and make it into a thing where there isn't a load of negative emotion and fear? And yeah, I just think scaremongering people with calorie counting is just not going to do any good.
Yeah, very much so. We need, with all these things, you know, scale it back and start with the next generation, isn't it? That's what it starts with, isn't it? You know, if we're going to make long-standing change. Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to talk about, your other campaign regarding the scales as well, because the idea that someone can't get the help they need based on how much they weigh is heartbreaking. I saw something on your grid again before we were going to talk the other week about someone who was going to let themselves deteriorate so they could get the help, and it made me feel poorly. Like I felt a physical reaction to reading that, and the fact that it's 2021 in this modern society and we can do all this stuff, and that's a thing, is like, you know, it's fucking heartbreaking, to be honest with you. You know, it's is the whole thing around you know, yeah, set up around BMI and weight and all that, that's how they gauge eating disorders. Is that right? Is that how the system...
Yeah, and it's so frustrating. I feel like I've been so frustrated on this podcast, sorry.
There's a lot going on, right? There's a lot. This is current as well, you know, so.
So eating disorders aren't supposed to be judged on BMI, and the NICE guidance kind of says that and is quite clear about it. But it's happening all over the country. And the government have just invested in some early intervention sites, but you can only access those sites if you've been unwell for a year or something, which then misses out a massive cohort of people who have been struggling for a long time. And because of the fact that there's no funding going into eating disorder services, it means that people are going to their GP, sharing what's happening, sharing their issues and concerns around food. And if they're not underweight, there is nothing available for them. And for me, it's not just about kind of scrapping BMI. It's like, we can't scrap BMI unless we're putting proper funding and training and understanding. And I think alongside that, like, quite often when someone goes to their doctor, and this isn't a dig at doctors, because I know doctors are really busy, but they only have 2 hours training on eating disorders. So when they turn someone away from treatment, they quite often get the language like a little bit wrong. And I've had cases where kind of people have shared with me conversations they've had, and even like messages where the doctors told them they're not thin enough to have an eating disorder, that they're not underweight enough. And eating disorders are such competitive illnesses that you automatically start competing with yourself, with others. You don't feel good enough. You don't feel like you deserve that support. And again, it puts kind of people who are underweight on a bit of a pedestal. And actually, that's just not right. And in some situations as well with eating disorders, people don't ever lose like that much weight. People might be overweight. They might stay the same weight. And it means that all of those people are going to be missed off any kind of service support.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're only kind of looking at the, I suppose, the extreme ends of the issue, and based on the physical, when it's a mental health issue. You know, it'd be like someone going to the doctor and say, I think I've got depression, and they say, go on, hop on the scales, you know, like, it is, what's the metric for it? It just doesn't make any sense. I think, again, with a lot of mental health issues, we tend to think, people think it falls into two camps, right? It's either like, it's happened to me, or it'll never happen to me. And what we're starting to learn with a lot of things now is that these things can happen to anybody, right? There's no kind of necessarily rhyme or reason or to it. Is there anything that you would say, and I know you can't speak for everyone and for every condition, but you know, for someone like myself, I haven't experienced it firsthand. I haven't experienced anything in that realm firsthand, but I've got small children, right? And as they grow up, they've got to navigate this modern world, and I have to help them the best I can. Is there anything that I should be like wary of, or looking out for, or keeping an eye on, or how can I do the best I can to make sure that they grow up with a healthy relationship around food?
Yeah, so I think as individuals, if you've got kids, it's like creating a safe space in the family home, so meal times aren't kind of negatively emotionally charged. In my family, we had a lot of family arguments at meal times, and again, fueling that negative emotion made it quite toxic in places. So yeah, keeping meal times kind of level is really important. I think being really mindful of your own relationship with food and exercise in your body. And I understand, and I 100% will do this. I know I will already, but I will probably look in the mirror at some point when I have kids and criticize my body. But it's important to try and not do that sort of stuff, and to not be labeling foods as good and bad, to be encouraging kids to be trying new things like snacking. Like if one of your kids comes home from school and they're like, oh, I feel really fat today. I feel like this. I don't want to eat that. I can't have that. So-and-so said this, or whatever it might be, like try and take some space to really, really unpack that. And I think with eating disorders, like they aren't, like I said at the start, like they're not about food. They're not about weight. They're not about body image. They're because something is going on for that individual, whether it's a fear of rejection or abandonment or what they're basing their self-worth on. So it's about actually creating an environment where they feel like they are heard and that they're understood. And I think as well, like if you're someone who's maybe listening to this, who's got a young person who's just like on that road to recovery, like realizing that you cannot be judging the severity of their mental health on their weight, and kind of reminding them that, you know, it's not about weight, you know, it's not about food, and you know that even if they're physically healthy and they're eating, like, you know, that stuff might still be going on for them. And I think the more we open up those dialogues and like normalize that conversation, I think the better it is. I do think with eating disorders, we're still really scared of talking about it. We're scared of triggering people. We're scared of upsetting people. And it's like, we need to move away from that and just realize that actually we need to be bringing all of these conversations out into the open.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really, really good point. You know, like even the word anorexia is a scary word. And quite often the way we see it portrayed on, you know, EastEnders or whatever, it's in these like really extreme situations because that's what gets viewers. But like in real life, it's just people, you know, going amongst their life. You do know what I mean? Like still having to cope with all the, or like going to school and like going to university and like to do all these things. It doesn't have to be this massive episode, which makes it quite so, quite so scary. Yeah. And could I ask you about exercise as well, Hope? Because obviously how we exercise is really like linked to, you know, to food and calories and all that sort of world. But I know that you're a big advocate of exercise as well. And how do you kind of juggle that with, you know, with recovery and all those sorts of things? Is that quite a blurred relationship at some points during the process?
Yeah, good question. very good question. Yeah, so one of the biggest mistakes I made in my recovery was not tackling my exercise dependency. So when I first went into treatment, I wasn't allowed to do any exercise for the first 10 months. And then for my final 2 months in treatment, I was allowed to go running kind of a couple of times a week with one of the nurses. And it was really helpful, and it was a really, really good starting point to understand about my relationship with exercise and things like that. And it was fine up until I relapsed. And then when I relapsed, I began to find it harder to navigate. And so how I have to deal with it is I have to be very, very strict with myself on exercise. I have someone that I'm accountable to with it. So if I feel like I'm wanting to exercise, I have to make myself kind of sit at home and process like feelings and emotions and just have space to kind of just offload onto normally a piece of paper or offload onto someone else. Sometimes it will be me literally standing opposite my other half and being like, I feel like this, I feel like this, I feel angry, I'm frustrated, I'm annoyed, I'm afraid if I don't exercise, this is what will happen, all of this sort of stuff. But I definitely am getting to a space where I don't feel like I have to manage it like that as much, but it takes time. And for me in the past, it's been about like, if I do feel like I'm getting obsessed with it again, like just cutting it out altogether and having like a couple of weeks where I don't do anything or where I don't even allow myself to go for a walk because I'm like, I cannot get into that kind of vicious cycle with it again. But alongside all of that, I am a real firm believer that exercise can be really helpful. And we know from like an endorphin releasing kind of aspect, it's really good. So I think for people with eating disorders and like an exercise dependency or any kind of disordered relationship with food and exercise, like we need to be trying to kind of, I guess, firstly talk about this sort of stuff really openly and realize that we're going to make mistakes. It's going to be hard, but also not, kind of giving people, I think, the skills to start exercising again. I get criticized a lot on social media if I share the exercise that I'm doing or if I take a photo. I'm like, oh, I've just been for a really nice run. It was great for my brain or something. But I think that shouldn't, I personally don't think that should be happening. I think if you've got a healthy relationship with exercise and food, you can get to that space where you can exercise and do what you want to do as long as you are fueling yourself. You're not doing it to punish yourself. You're not doing it to lose weight and you're not doing it to kind of switch off from emotions.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, it's important for people to see that people who are going through something because you, as much as you need help and support on that journey, but you also need to, you know, sort of see that things are possible and see that you can have that, you know, you can get your, if you love running, then you can get that back, you know, that you can love that again. Do you have any other tools in the toolbox, Hope, day to day for kind of looking after yourself in general, you know, just with all aspects of your mental health and just kind of like being a, you know, a more, in a better place?
Yeah. So I guess, so looking at the whole week, so I try and start my day and finish my day quite similar most days, Monday to Friday, which sounds like I'm really boring. And obviously some days it doesn't always work, but I try and journal for 10 minutes before I go to bed, just because it helps me to just kind of offload everything that's going on in my head. And not just like, that isn't always kind of mental health stuff and fears and whatever it might be, but it's also just giving that space to kind of offload a load of work stuff that's probably come up that day. I'm also at the moment going through like a phase of reparenting myself. So sometimes I'll lie in bed in the evening and I kind of tell myself all of that stuff that I wish my parents had said to me, I wish that other people would say to me. So trying to become a bit more of like, and I hate the phrase, but like my own cheerleader in this. So not really relying on others for that. Once a week I will see a friend, whether that's for a walk, whether that's to have like, I don't know, a phone call if we're in the pandemic, things like that, but actually making sure that I'm still staying connected to people. What else? I go to church once a week, which really, really helps, and kind of prioritize that actually. So even if work stuff comes up, that's always a priority for me because I know that that's really helpful for me. And I try and have one slower morning a week, which is quite easy for me to say because I don't have a family. But normally on a Saturday or a Sunday, I will kind of, whether it's going and sitting outside and having a cup of tea or going and sitting in a cafe, hopefully now things are opening up, or just like sitting on my sofa and things like that. And I think for me, it felt uncomfortable at first, but again, I see the benefits of doing all of that sort of stuff. And I think within all of it, it's like, as individuals, like we need to identify maybe those things that are slightly triggering to us and things that cause us stress and anxiety and things that, kind of upset us. And once we start to identify some of those, we can then find a better way to respond. So I kind of do a lot of that stuff. I sound like I'm really probably doing loads, and it's not. And it's taken, I think, I really just want to emphasize, it's taken me such a long time to kind of build up this kind of, I don't know, toolbox or whatever of things that work for me. Like it's taken me, I don't know, 11, 12 years, and I definitely get it wrong sometimes. And there's weeks when I do none of that stuff and I get to like Sunday night and I'm like, why am I in such a bad mood? Why do I feel like this? So I think it's, I guess I just wanted to, I'm not perfect. I just want to make sure know that.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you know, a lot of the stuff you mentioned there as well is like, it's so simple, you know, and I love the fact that you set it all out, because I think that that's what we don't do as modern humans, you know. Like if you don't, like for me, I'm very similar to yourself. If I don't put it in my diary to catch up with a mate or something like that, probably don't happen. And when life's busy, that's the stuff that goes. Your slow morning, that's the bit that goes. And these are the things that can kind of help us so much. And you're right, it takes a long time to figure that out. And it's like the goalposts keep moving, right? So I can kind of piece my own puzzle together and that'll work for a little bit. And then all of a sudden it feels like it doesn't. And I'm like, ah, crap, I need to kind of adjust and need to find something else or take something out or juggle it all around. But if people want to know more about your campaign work and stuff like that, where's the best place to get involved, Hope?
Probably on Instagram. I share every campaigning thing on there pretty much. So it's just Hope Virgo with an underscore. And then you can sign the petition for the campaign on change.org if you just search Dump the Scales.
Fantastic. Oh, cool. And I'll put all the links to that in the episode notes as well. Well, Hope, I really enjoyed that, mate. Thank you so much for joining me. I think that's going to be a really useful episode. I feel like I learned a lot, so that means there'll be someone listening who can learn a lot too. But thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much for asking me. It was fun.
Thank you for listening from the Proper Mental Podcast. Please like and subscribe.
Plus 5 stars.